A Skinflint podcast brought to you by Nextmune UK, a specialist in veterinary dermatology and immunotherapy in association with elearning.vet.
Hello and welcome to the next episode of Skinflint, the podcast which has now passed over 5,000 downloads. That was a nice little celebration. We got a party poppers out for that one. Welcome along, and we're going to be having more conversations tonight about dermatology in the veterinary world and pets and dermatology. And we're going to be talking about a little bit about the responsible use of antimicrobials today. So, I never introduced myself, so I feel like I should say, well, if you need a nurse who knows a bit more about dermatology, perhaps you've just got a lack of somebody who doesn't shut up and you need to host a podcast, you need a shot of John Redbondaloxine. That's me, John Redbond. Welcome along. These get worse every time. And if you my co-host as ever here tonight, if you're online and you're having internet issues or something like that, perhaps you need some more subscribers for your e-learning platform, then you need a bit of Paul Hees Minicillin. Hello, Paul.
Good evening, John. Hello. It's the end of the day and the end of my wits, I think, at this point.
Absolutely. We're recording this podcast in the evening, as you can probably tell. And perhaps you're just lacking in expertise in the field of dermatology and you need the strongest dose of concentrated dermatology knowledge. Well, you need a dose of Sue Patterson-O-Mycin. Hello, Sue.
Thanks, John. You're certainly building your part up. It gets bigger and bigger every week we do these, I think. So keep going. Well, I mean, I have to say I'm really looking forward to today's podcast. We're talking to a really good friend of mine who's got a very unpronounceable Finnish name. We're speaking to Katariina Vorjanen, which I probably completely mispronounced. But she's a European diplomat in veterinary dermatology. And what's really interesting, she's going to talk to us about the approach to otitis in Scandinavia. I lectured in Scandinavia a couple of months ago now, and really struck me how careful they are with their antibiotic use and how they use a lot of antiseptics, they use a lot of anti-inflammatories. And I had made me rethink perhaps my approach to otitis externa. So it'd be really great to chat to Katariina about that. So I'm looking forward to chatting in just a few moments.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, let's get straight on with that, because we have a serious conversation with Katariina to have. So less of my nonsense. So yeah, without any further ado, let's bring in Katariina.
So thank you, Katariina, for joining us. It's really great to have the opportunity to chat with you. Just start off, for those members of our audience who don't know who you are, just start by introducing yourself. Give us a brief CV, if you will.
Right. Thank you for having me. So my name is Katariina Vorjanen and I'm Finnish, but I've lived outside Finland for the last sort of 40 years, 30 something at least. I did my undergraduate studies in Sweden at the University of Agricultural Sciences in Uppsala, and then my specialist training in the UK at the Royal Veterinary College. And during the last 10 years or so, I've worked as a dermatologist only, really. Whilst prior to that, I did a fair number of years in general practice with small animals.
And you're very involved with ESVD, and are you not incoming president of the European Society of Veterinary Dermatology, Katariina?
Yes, I guess that's the plan at the moment, at least, that in a year's time I'll step up as president, yes.
So that would tend to imply you probably know a little bit about veterinary dermatology, I would suggest.
Hopefully, but there's always more to know.
Yeah, and what I think is really interesting, and I think you're really unique in this, in that you've worked obviously in Scandinavia, and we know that the Scandinavian approach to antimicrobial use is very different, and actually I would suggest is very much better than our approach in the UK. They're very strict in the way they control their antimicrobial use. You've worked in the UK, but you've also worked in the States, and I would suggest that we've probably got both ends of the spectrum there about appropriate antimicrobial use. So I think it'd be really interesting to chat to you and get your experiences about how antimicrobials are used in each of those different areas and ways in which you think that's good and ways in which perhaps we could improve. So first of all, shall we start off with experiences as why we think responsible antimicrobial use is important? Because we know that it's a very hot topic at the moment, certainly in the UK, certainly in Europe. Why is it, from a dermatology perspective, is it important we use antimicrobials responsibly?
Well, I guess one thing is the why it's important from the dermatology perspective, but it always ties into the One Health perspective as well, because we do need to be careful in our use of antimicrobials to ensure that we don't ruin their use for any other species, including people. So tying into small animals, I don't think it's dermatology only. I think this is certainly something we work with throughout the entire veterinary profession in trying to cut down on the use of antimicrobials and the time when we do use them, the time we need to use them, so that we don't use antimicrobials for longer than absolutely necessary. And I guess the difficulty in comparing countries here is that this is very much an evolving area in veterinary medicine. And whilst antimicrobial use 10 years ago might have been a little bit more loose in all countries, really, most have put quite a lot of work into trying to reduce unnecessary use of antimicrobials. Not that we shouldn't use them when we need them, but to try to identify those areas where we, if you say, get away with not using them and can do as good a job and in treating our pets as we without antimicrobials as we did with them.
And so, I have to say I admire the Scandinavian approach to the use of antimicrobials. Tell me, just outline for people who perhaps don't know, as a veterinary surgeon in, let's say, Sweden, because I know you've worked across large areas of Scandinavia, as a veterinary surgeon in Sweden, what boxes do you have to tick in order to prescribe antimicrobials to dogs and cats? And which antimicrobials do you have access to? Which antibiotics can you use as a vet in Sweden?
So they aren't completely off limits, but we do have practice guidelines that are strict in terms of recommendations of how we use antimicrobials, and then we have some limitations in what is actually available on the market. There is a legislation in place since a number of years now where particularly fluoroquinolones and third generation cephalosporins are limited in how easily we can access them, legislation that says that we need to be in a life-threatening situation or have a culture and sensitivity test that tells us that these drugs are really the only thing we can use, and we need to justify their use in the clinical records. And that has significantly cut down on particularly fluoroquinolone use, whilst the third generation cephalosporins never came into fashion before this legislation was passed.
And those are what we refer to as critically important antibiotics, aren't they, when we're looking at human use of those? Is that right?
Yes, and that's very much the reasoning for that legislation to be in place, that we don't overuse them and use them out of convenience rather than necessity in veterinary medicine.
And I mean, for that sounds amazing, Katerina, from a UK perspective, which is that my only personal knowledge of the use of these. I mean, that sounds almost quite extreme, really, to not have access to certain antibiotics at all, certainly without the proof of a test. For you, I just want to push you a little bit on the differences between the countries, without obviously wanting to suggest that we're not doing things as well over here. All the vets are doing their best, but in terms of the progression of veterinary medicine, would, in your eyes, would how things are being done in Scandinavia be a few years ahead of here? And what's the situation in the US as well?
I think we have a bit of a difference in terms of culture, because we are quite small countries, and that means that the veterinary community has been quite small as well. And that means, as a result, that the information is passed a lot more easily to all vets, and many know each other, and it's easier to get across with new practice guidelines and so forth. The other aspect is that the government side and public health sector has worked very hard in the Scandinavian countries in using information to the public, really to make them positive to use less antimicrobials when those aren't needed. So we aren't pushed from our clients into giving antibiotics at all in the same way that you might be pushed working in other countries, because the general public is actually very positive to not using antibiotics.
And I think that's really interesting that you're still able to maintain animal health and welfare without having to reach for those types of drugs, except perhaps under exceptional circumstances. Do you think it's easier to treat? I mean, let's for example, talk about ear disease. Do you think it's easier to treat ear disease in Scandinavia than it is in the UK because you're not seeing as many resistant bacteria? Or are there situations where you would like to have access, perhaps first line, to some of the drugs that we have in the UK to treat ear disease? What's your personal feeling about that, Katarina?
I do have access to the same active substances if I need them. But I think a huge difference in the cases I see in Scandinavia compared to cases I have seen in the UK, in referral practice in the UK, is that they are usually seen at an earlier stage in the disease, and that we are perhaps more keyed into the preventative treatment once we have recognized that this is a case that ends up with recurrent inflammation of the ears or chronic inflammation of the ears, that we do use a lot more of the topical steroids to try to keep that inflammation contained and stop the progression into those driving factors that cause stenosis and hypoplasia and eventually middle ear disease as well. So the caseload differs in terms of severity in referral practice, and that's quite a marked difference. And I think that is part of the benefit of the Scandinavian countries, is that the information about using topicals as a preventative treatment has penetrated really well into the veterinary community, and people know that this is important. Whilst here, I think it isn't quite as widespread knowledge, really.
Well, hopefully this podcast will really help with that, Katarina. Thank you. Because, you know, absolutely, I guess this is where the direction that we're trying to head in. And it's so interesting as well hearing you say that it's almost cultural. So presumably, when you talk about catching ear disease early and thinking about, you know, the different causes and confirmation and those sorts of things which can cause ear disease in certain breeds and all those kinds of factors that we need to think about. Are owners, would you say, in Scandinavia kind of more in tune with thinking early on with their dog with a certain breed and confirmation, or I'd better try and catch this early?
No, I don't think so. No, I think it's more that it ends up as a discussion early on when we have these young dogs coming in with clinical signs of atopic dermatitis in particular, because that's at the end of it the most common cause of recurrent ear problems and chronic ear problems, and that this is identified early on and discussed and very early on, even before marked problems have developed, that cleaning practices are used or topical anti-inflammatories to try to contain that inflammation from progressing.
So thinking about that then, as it is the vet side then, whether it's culturally perhaps a little bit further on, clue us in, let's cycle it back a little bit, clue us into some of the things that we can be looking out for to identify that early on with infection. Would you say it's any one thing, looking at smell, the discharge that you have in the ear or performing cytology?
I think for most of us, it's the pet that presents fairly early in life with otitis, or clinical signs of otitis, so head shaking, scratching its ear. Usually at that point in time, they do have a secondary infection. Already at that stage, this is the first time, but if it ends up recurring, we will need to discuss the underlying cause and try to prevent repeat. But usually we treat the first time around and then see if it returns. But whether we start that discussion, ideally, I think, very early on, so that the owners get accustomed to that this is actually something that might be causing the ear disease, and that this primary disease is something we should address and need to address or contain as well as we can to try to prevent those progressive disease stages from developing.
So essentially, when you have a case that's referred to you as a referral clinician, it's not just about treating the infection. It's about having that conversation with an owner and saying, well, sure, we can treat the infection, but obviously we need to work out why that infection has taken place. And you've already said that the allergies are really important underlying cause of infection in dogs. That's essentially what we're dealing with, isn't it?
It is. I mean, in almost every single case, there is going to be an allergy underlying it. I tend to explain this as the dog variant of atopic eczema, but it's in the ear canals, and that we do need to address that, ideally by identifying what drives that inflammation. So can we identify an allergy and remove that? That's obviously ideal, but otherwise prevent it from flaring and changing the environment to something that bacteria and yeast thrive in.
So talk me through your approach to a case. So a client comes in with their dog. The dog has been diagnosed with ear disease. What do you obviously take your history? You do your general examination. You do your dermatological examination. So when it comes to looking at the ear, talk me through your approach to how you'd look at that ear.
So I would try to make an assessment of the ear canal itself. I tend to start with palpating the ear canal, so the cartilage, to get an idea of, or am I already feeling changes to the ear canal in terms of more firm ear canals than normal, or do I still have a nice give in the cartilage that surrounds, basically the ear canal itself. And part of that is also to make the dog more accustomed to me handling the ears and that it isn't painful. If the dog allows, I will do an otoscopic exam conscious. If it doesn't allow me to do that because the ears are too painful, I might sedate the animal, or I might just do cytology to see what am I dealing with in terms of pathogens and try to look at the opening to the ear canal or how narrow the ear canal has gotten. And if it's very inflamed and very narrow, I might, in many cases, if not most cases, actually start with trying to opening up that ear canal before pursuing any further diagnostics or treatments, and just go to anti-inflammatory treatment and cleaning to try to open up the ear canal so I can visualize properly at the next visit.
So I want to come back to talk about anti-inflammatories, and I want to talk about cleaning and stuff. But let's go back a step and talk about cytology. So first of all, explain what you mean by cytology for members of our audience who perhaps aren't aware of it, and also talk me through how you do that and why it's important.
So cytology is very much the basic diagnostic investigation for ear disease for me, and it's easy to do in most cases. Cytology will mean that I take some material out of the ear canal and roll it out on a slide, stain that. I tend to use normal DiffQuick staining and assess in the microscope if I can see any pathogens, really. Do I see bacteria? And if I see bacteria, are they round, so cocci, or are they rod-shaped bacteria, or am I dealing with yeast overgrowth and fungal infection rather than bacterial infection? So separating rods, cocci and yeast, because that will give me an idea of what I might need to use, but also of how much of a load of infection I'm looking at, in terms of am I just seeing the small numbers of pathogens in the ear canal, or am I seeing many and have a more severe overgrowth or infection?
So everything you're describing here, Katerina, sounds, forgive me for saying, but it sounds quite basic, really, in that you're talking about feeling the ear, feeling for how hard or soft the ear is just from the outside, having a look down the ear. And then what you're describing there with the cytology, that sounds like a very simple, basic test. Is my assessment right there? And is this something which you need to be a specialist to do? Does it need specialized equipment? Or is this something that could be done by a vet nurse, for example?
It's certainly a very straightforward test to do. And I guess for many specialists, it is the nurse who does it for us, because it saves us time and time to speak with the owner rather than to do the staining and even the microscopy. And so the assessment in the microscope, a nurse can do for you with some training. And we are not looking at being specialist cytologists here. We are looking at, are we seeing round, rod-shaped or budding things in the microscope? And they are quite straightforward to separate from each other once you've done it a few times. I guess we also look for whether there's presence of inflammatory cells or a lot of discharge in the background around these bugs. But even so, it is straightforward really to learn to do that, and it shouldn't take you more than a couple of minutes once you are up to speed on it, looking at these samples. In most dogs, you are absolutely able to go down with a Q-tip down the ear canal and take a sample from the vertical ear canal where it goes into the horizontal ear canal. So I tend to avoid in a conscious animal to try to sample the horizontal ear canal, but just go down along the head, pointing the Q-tip sort of towards the floor when the dog is sitting, and just taking a swab and rolling it out on a slide. And it would be reasonably uncommon for dogs not to allow that. If they are very fractious, I might just use my fingers actually and poke a clean finger in the ear canal and just get the material at the opening and look at that to get an idea of what I'm dealing with.
That's a really useful tip actually. Finger into the ear if it's difficult with a cotton bud or a Q-tip.
Yes, for some dogs, they will be absolutely happy with that. But as soon as you come with your cotton bud, they also don't know what are you going to do.
It's
going
to be, they can see you coming. And it's music to my ears, if you'll pardon the pun, to hear you say that, you know, it's nurses that generally are the ones doing your cytology, because I'm a nurse myself. So having done this in practice and knowing that it's something that you can do as a nurse and really make a difference. I'd encourage any nurses listening to get involved, or vets to get the nurses involved, and that they can also do the, you know, looking down the microscope to see what's down there as well.
It's actually quite fun. So I at times I do go and look. Well, I do quite frequently look at some stage myself a little bit as well, because it's just fun, and you get the gut feeling on how many are there down there. But no, the bulk of the work is done by the nurses.
Sure. And is that something that you would do, the cytology, just in that initial stage? Or would you use that kind of following up as a way of monitoring? Or
I do cytology all the time. Every time I see them, I repeat the cytology, because at the end of it, I'm using a lot of anti-inflammatories, because any ear drop really will contain an anti-inflammatory medication, which means that the dog is going to improve. And the only way I have of monitoring that secondary infection is cytology, because I can't just use my clinical assessment. I need cytology to know if I'm actually achieving what I want to achieve with my treatment, so reduced numbers of microbes.
And so you would decide on your endpoint of therapy when you would switch from treatment onto maintenance would be where you've got no inflammation, no inflammatory cells, and the levels of bacteria or yeast are down to what you would consider normal. Is that when you would then start to change from treatment to maintenance?
Yes, absolutely. I would really want to see that happening on my cytology before I go to maintenance, to see that I'm currently in control and I can swap over to preventing rather than treating. The other aspect of cytology and where it's useful is to see whether the treatment you have selected is actually helping, because if your bacterial or fungal numbers aren't reducing with whatever treatment you are using, you do need to consider why that is happening and do some sort of amendment to your treatment to ensure that you are actually going in the right direction and hopefully can see an improvement at the next visit.
This podcast is brought to you by Nextmune UK, the specialists in veterinary dermatology and immunotherapy. Nextmune bring you products such as Otodine and CLX wipes, market-leading products in the management of skin and ear cases.
So essentially, let's then go back. You mentioned before about your first steps in therapy, and essentially anti-inflammatories, you feel, and I absolutely agree, are really important, and also some flushing, some ear cleaners. So what sort of actives would you use to start off with when you've done your cytology? Let's say you've just found some bacteria, perhaps you found some cocci, some staphylococcus. What would your approach to that case be? Give me names of products that you would, not necessarily names of products, names of actives that you would consider using. What would your go-to be?
So the other thing I would consider in the selection of a cleanser is the texture of that discharge in the ear canal, and I would select my cleanser based on whether that is a fatty discharge, so a ceruminous discharge that I need to dissolve some sort of lipid material, and for that type of discharge I would most commonly go to a squalene based ear cleanser, or if it's a fairly liquid and with pus forming, I would most commonly go to something that contains chlorhexidine, some Tricidin-TA, particularly if there are rod-shaped bacteria or biofilm, I would aim to use that. And if I suspect that there is biofilm, so that it's a very slimy discharge, I would lean towards acetylcysteine as an additional product, or potentially the only cleanser.
So you're cleansing with those, and that depends on what the ear looks like. And then what about anti-inflammatories? Do you use them into the ear? Do you give them by mouth? Do you give tablets? Do you give injection? Give me a feel about your approach to anti-inflammatory use.
So anti-inflammatories would very much depend on the severity of the inflammation. So what I would interpret as narrowing of the ear canal or thickening of the lining of the ear canal wall, so basically hyperplasia of the skin in the ear canals. And if I have a very stenosed ear canal, I would always, so very narrowed ear canal diameter, I would always reach for oral steroids in addition to topical ones. If I have just minor changes in inflammatory changes in the ear canals, I would use just a topical. I would always use a topical and then add in the systemics of tablet medication if the ear canal is very inflamed, or at times if I want to reduce pus formation, because steroids will reduce the amount of neutrophilic discharge.
And so, which is great, but my question to you is, if you're going to use a topical steroid, how do you use a topical steroid without using an antibiotic and without using an antimycotic and anti-yeast drug at the same time? Do you accept the fact that, you know, licensed under the Cascade, we have to use that? Or do you use your clinical judgment to say, actually, I'm going to go off license, I'm going to go off Cascade and use something else? So how do you use that steroid topically?
So I would use a steroid as such, so not use the antifungals and particularly not the antibiotics if I'm not entirely sure that the antibiotic is going to reach where I need it to go and do a good job. So again, if I do, my goal is really to open up that ear canal, because I don't believe my products are going to reach where I need them to go, I would use a steroid only. And the Cascade is a bit, I mean, it's, Cascade, at least for us, hasn't been tried in what does it strictly speaking mean, because the licensed products for the ears are these polypharmaceutical products, and we are obliged to use them, but if we don't have the active substance that we are looking for, except in these polypharmaceuticals, we don't really know if it's not absolutely fine to go to the single substance that might still be licensed, but not for that purpose, and use that instead. And I think that's one of those gray areas in veterinary medicine where at least in for me, the antibiotic stewardship and ensuring I'm not using excessive amounts of antibiotics when they are not giving me any help wins over, am I in a gray zone here or not? And I would use a topical corticosteroid such as hydrocortisone acetonate that is a component of an air product as combined with an antibiotic and an antifungal, but I used only the steroid containing one. And we do have a licensed steroid combined with salicylic acid that can also be applied topically. And there are certainly times when I use the injectable steroids and apply them into the ear canal.
So yeah, different ways of getting around. Like, I totally get what you're saying there, Katerina, that the cascade obviously is there to ensure that the drugs are used properly, aren't they? That's the kind of spirit of the principle. But actually, if in some way or other that's directing you towards using something that has a lot of different products in, some of which aren't the correct product to use in that situation, or as we're talking about on here, could actually cause a problem, you know, globally with overuses of certain types of antibiotics and things, that you're using your clinical judgment and your reasoning with that case to actually perhaps go towards something else which would be a more appropriate to use singly, like a steroid or something that isn't a steroid in with some antibiotic.
Yes. Yeah, that's certainly one of the areas where we can reduce antimicrobial use. And particularly with some of our ear pathogens, Pseudomonas would be the main one. If we do apply an antibiotic and we are not able to get that antibiotic to where we need it, so that there's still too much pus, it can't penetrate through the ear canal, what we are really doing is selecting for those antibiotic resistant strains that Pseudomonas will have, and we get suddenly a Pseudomonas that's going to be a lot more resistant to antibiotics. So I do aim to, when I do reach for those antibiotics, ensure that what I've done with that ear prior to that makes that antibiotic as useful as possibly can be.
Which kind of brings us back around to what you were saying about your use of the topicals in terms of the discharge or what you're seeing in the ear, because what you're saying there is that you can, by removing all of that first, you're going to give the antibiotic the best chance of working, so it's appropriate to use those first. I'm interested as well if because you talked about an acetylcysteine for biofilms, but if they're the topicals that you're using, the cleaners, what are those that we have that have an effect on the bugs that we may see down there? So the things that we would eventually could be considering using an antibiotic for, so bacteria and yeast and those sorts of things.
Absolutely. I mean, what we quite frequently see is that if we start with reducing inflammation and using a cleaner that has antibacterial properties and just physically, mechanically washing out the discharge, we allow that ear canal to actually heal itself as well, and we are probably getting a fair amount of help from the immune system once we normalize the environment a bit more to help us deal with that infection. So we do have a number of the cleansers that have antiseptic properties in addition to the mechanical washing, with chlorhexidine and acetylcysteine being antibacterial in their own right. And then we quite frequently, particularly with the rod-shaped bacteria, then use 3-CDTA as well to weaken bacterial cell walls. And all the 3-CDTA on its own isn't antibacterial. If we combine that with a bit of chlorhexidine or something that helps us kill that bacteria, or hypochlorous acid for that matter, we are actually doing a fairly good job with antiseptics.
I think it's really interesting and it's really comforting to hear you talking about the importance of steroids in ear disease. I would absolutely completely agree. They open the canal up, they reduce the discharge, they make the animal feel more comfortable, because we know that's really, really important. And I know when I've lectured in Scandinavia, I've been really taken by the fact that the Scandinavian vets use a lot of antiseptics before they reach for antibiotics, but use steroids in order to reduce that inflammation and soreness. And I think there's lots of lessons here that we could perhaps learn in the UK, because there's a great temptation perhaps to reach for antibiotics too soon. I don't know what your thoughts are with that, Katrina.
I think it makes us feel safer, because we are, if we have always done that, taking the steps into not doing it and then believing it, that it actually works, it's a large step and it's a bit scary to do that. And I think when we have justification to why we are not doing or using antibiotics, and we are not harming the animal, because we do need to reduce that inflammation, we do need to increase comfort, we do need to clean discharge, and then having them back 2 weeks later, and if we repeat the cytology and see, oh, the bacterial numbers or the fungal numbers are dropping here very rapidly, well, there's no reason not to continue with what you are doing for a bit longer and see, are we actually getting resolution with only doing that? And in a number of cases, 2 weeks later, they are actually already rid of the secondary infection and there was no need at all to go to anything else. I would say that for me, if I do the antiseptic and anti-inflammatory treatment and have them back 2 weeks later and the number of microbes in that ear isn't improving, then I would switch into using antibiotics, antifungals, and say, well, I will need them in this case. But it's very much like the reasoning for pyoderma. We start with shampooing and with chlorhexidine shampoos, and if they don't improve in 2 weeks, well, then we have justification to say we might need antibiotics here.
And I think you're absolutely right. And I think perhaps the way that we manage ear disease, perhaps a little bit behind the curve. I think there's an acceptance now that we can use topical therapy, because there's obviously evidence there out there that antiseptics, whether it's chlorhexidine or hypochlorous or whatever it happens to be, are really useful and can be used to manage pyoderma, skin infections without antibiotics. And perhaps we should be starting to look at the same approach, I think, for ear disease as well. Would you agree?
Yes, and I do think we need the studies to show that it works and how well it works and what the percentage of cases that it does work in is. And at the moment, we are really looking at anecdotal evidence and people who are doing it and feel that it is helpful rather than studies that say this is. But we do have studies to show that only antiseptic cleaning of ears can resolve an ear infection. So, but my belief is that the anti-inflammatories, topical steroids or plus minus systemic steroids, will further enhance that effect, but anecdotal.
And I just want to, it's been so fascinating, Katarina, talking over this. I do just want to push you both, if I can, on whether how important this is, because, you know, we've talked about some of the elements of it. I'm thinking, you know, there was the movie that came out in 2018, Resistance, and there's been a growing kind of feeling of a need that this is a real problem. And so, you know, it's great to talk about it, but is this something that people really need to be taking seriously? And I'm wondering, Sue, you know, with your role with the RCVS as well, is this something that there needs to be more coming down from above in terms of trying to enforce people to follow these rules, or trying to get the right culture going, as it is in Scandinavia?
Well, I think the most important part where we need to cut down our antibiotic use is when we use systemics. Topicals are obviously somewhat less of a concern and in the general health perspective, because we are not treating the gut bacteria when we are using topicals only. However, I do think that we are selecting and doing things to the normal flora in the ear canals if we are reaching too soon for our antibiotics, and avoiding that antimicrobial shift from yeast to then ending up with Pseudomonas because we have overused topical antibiotics is something we really need to strive for.
And I couldn't agree more. I think one of the things that we underuse is cytology, and obviously you've talked about that. I think one of the things that we should be doing as clinicians is establishing that infection is present first to make sure that we aren't going to use drugs that aren't needed at all. We need to make sure that when we use drugs, we use them to make sure that the infection is actually gone. We need to make sure that we have prevented return of the infection. And I think if we did all those things, then that would go a long, long way to using antimicrobials responsibly. We need to have antimicrobials, and I think more than one person has said the greatest threat to civilization is multiply resistant infections. The less antibiotics we use, the less we need, because we turn on the resistance mechanisms of bugs by feeding them antibiotics. So I think, you know, we need to perhaps start to look at things in a slightly different way. But, you know, there's a huge engagement, certainly from the professions in the UK. I know certainly it's the same in Europe. And people are looking for opportunities and looking at ways in which they can reduce their antimicrobial usage. So it's encouraging to hear, you know, that we are approaching this particular way.
And a lot has happened during just the last few years. We are working on with this very actively, I think, all over the world by now.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Katharina, for joining us and for sharing all of the wealth of your knowledge and Sue for your reflections and wrapping that up at the end so nicely. Some big lessons to learn, but it's great to hear that example, I think, of what's happening in Scandinavia, that there can be a cultural shift to move towards those things. And hopefully this episode of Skinflint will just go a little bit towards that. So thank you very much for joining us. And hopefully I'm sure we'll have you back on again soon.
Thank you, Katharina. Nice to speak to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Cheers.
Okay, well, that was a brilliant conversation with Katharina. That was so fascinating. There was so much to take from that, Sue, and such a massive conversation. We could talk about that for ages. But did you have any other reflections or anything, Sue, on that?
I just think it was really comforting for me. Obviously, I'm quite passionate about appropriate antimicrobial use, and it was great to hear Katharina's take on it as well. And the fact that we've got whole nations here, you know, we're looking at Sweden and Norway and Finland and Denmark as well, who have really started to scrutinise the way in which they use antibiotics. And the important thing as well is not just about reducing our use, but reducing our use without compromising animal health and welfare. You know, it's great for us to bang on about thou shalt not use antibiotics, but we have a responsibility as veterinary professionals, both vets and nurses, to make sure that what we do is in the best interest of the animals that we treat. And it's nice to know that you can use less but not compromise health and welfare. So it was really, really interesting for me, and I hope our listeners have found it useful as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, do get in touch if there's anything. If you want to ask Sue anything, or you want to ask us anything in a follow-up to it, we can always put those questions to her. So, Paul, how would people go about doing that?
Yes, so you can. We obviously post about the podcast on our social media channels, so you can comment there. You can send an email in to hello@elearning.vet. There are many ways that you can get in touch with us and let us know your thoughts.
Absolutely, brilliant. But yeah, let's wrap this up then with one of my slightly daft questions, just to get into the minds of you two. If there was a shot of something, not an antibiotic, but a drug that could fix the thing in life that annoys you the most, what would it fix? And we'll start with you, Paul.
Your questions, possibly. I think if I could just...
I think I walked head first into that.
It probably doesn't annoy me most in life, but it certainly... Makes me think at the end of these podcasts.
It's up there. And is it the question at the end or the intro at the beginning? Yeah, that's the other big question. Yeah, which? How about you, Sue?
So I thought I'd just finish by lowering the whole tone of the whole podcast for you and tell you that my husband is a lager drinker, and there's quite a lot of gas in lager. And unfortunately, it has a little bit of a time to percolate through his system, which means that at certain times during the night, the bedclothes will rise in a slightly unearthly way. So if there was a little tablet that I could get him to take at the same time that he has his lager that counteracts the side effects of the lager drinking, I would be a very happy bunny, because I put up for it. We've been married for over 30 years, and for 30 years, I put up with rising bedclothes. So I'd be very happy if you could get me a tablet that did that job.
Let's see if we can get our sponsors Next Meme working on that, shall we? Fantastic. Well, as ever, guys, thank you so much for joining me on this podcast. And yeah, it's been great, as always, to spend time with you. And yeah, and all of you listening as well, we hope that you've enjoyed it. It's been really fascinating. And don't forget to subscribe if you haven't done already. Don't forget to check out the show notes if you want to, if there was anything you didn't quite catch. We always have extensive show notes. And yeah, we'll see you along on the next Skinflint.
See you, everybody.
Goodbye.
The Skinflint podcast brought to you by Nextmune UK, the specialist in veterinary dermatology and immunotherapy in association with elearning.vet.